Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America, is proud to present A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The Rav delivered this series of 12 lectures in 1958 and 1959 before an audience of Jewish social service professionals as part of a program of the Jewish Education Committee of New York. Using audio files provided by the Toras HaRav Foundation, these recordings have been curated and remastered by Mark Smilowitz in order to provide the best listening and learning experience. For more information, including full transcriptions and supplementary materials for this series, please visit the Tradition website at traditiononline.org/JPM. Lecture 7, Prophetic Loneliness as the Solution to the Problem of Jewish Loneliness, originally delivered on February 12, 1959.
Many a time he's rejected by the community he wants to join. But still, of course, we have to experience both loneliness and aloneness. Loneliness, I said before, using an Adlerian term, is a disjunctive emotion, very excruciating emotion, very destructive emotion. Aloneness can become a very creative emotion. Of course, we experience both. There is not a single person under the sun who did not experience some aloneness, rejection, non-acceptance, you know, that. And on the other hand, who also experiences aloneness, his uniqueness, his incommensurability with others, the fact that others don't understand him, but not as a destructive emotion. More, he feels it, he experiences it more as part of his personal dignity. That I'm so different, that I cannot be replaced, I'm indispensable as far as my contribution to society, but indispensable, my inner world is indispensable.
There is not another inner world, which is commensurate with mine. So, of course, he experiences both. But, nevertheless, not all people experience a loneliness and aloneness equally. Some are so engrossed in their objectivating mission, in passing on their charisma, their message, in living for others, in externalizing themselves, that they simply have not time to dally in themselves, to exist for themselves, in a unique, unrepeatable manner. That the feeling of aloneness is almost alien to them. This motherness is so busy to somehow to make the other self, the Tao, understand him, to impress the Tao, to impose himself upon society. He's so busy doing all that, an externalization of his. And externalization means always universalization. It means also, standardization. Standardization, to show that I am like others. I'm a regular fellow, so to say. I'm one of the crowd. That he forgets to live for himself. That finally, of course, the feeling of aloneness is almost alien to him. And if disappointment comes, and disappointment is bound to come, so he is a lonely being, not a being alone. He's a lonely being. There are always those people, and I'm speaking to you as a rabbi now, because this mental disposition is particularly very discernible among rabbis. I don't know other professions, but I know pretty well my profession. I mean, the people are engaged in my profession. They are always haunted by the malaise of modern society, perhaps by the fear we would not find recognition, by uncertain presentiments they will be not wanted. They are so busy, they are so preoccupied with this idea, to such an extent they forget the numinous facets of their own experience. We lack self-rootedness. Basically, Judaism spoke of men in terms of a tree. Ki Adam Itz HaSadeh. A man is like the tree in the field. what it means. And in the Bible, in particular in the Psalms, in Jeremiah, you'll find this metaphor, man tree, a very popular one employed by the prophet and the psalmist. What does the tree, first of all, tree means that man is an organic creature, an organic being, but more, man must be rooted. Tree is rooted in soil. Man is also rooted. Where is he rooted? Of course, the final place where man strikes roots is infinity. But Judaism was not metaphysically orientated. Judaism was very realistic. So before man strikes roots in infinity, he should also find himself rooted in finitude. Where is the finitude? He can strike roots. Where? In himself. In himself. In his depth personality. In the deep recesses of his consciousness. And many people lack rootedness completely. And of course, if they lack rootedness, we have no self-experience. We have experience of many things. Their minds are sharp. Their vocabulary is rich. I mean, they are very, very, their sense of esprit is very developed in them. Their culture of educators. They're excellent technicians. But they experience the outside world. They don't experience themselves. This is basically for Judaism. This is the, so to say, the termination of the religious experience. Self-experience. They identify themselves with their objectivated or objectified reflection. They identify themselves with the reflection they see in the mirror. And of course, this mirror is society. The Tao, the other fellow, what he thinks of me. Not what I am, but how I impress others. This is the I. With the public picture, without knowing that there is a private world of their own. And the public picture is never commensurate with the private world. And usually, the private world is much richer and more comely and lovely and more graceful than their public world. Of course, these people are susceptible, very susceptible to public criticism and indifference. A remark by the Tao about their abilities or talents will shatter their existence. May bring the people to almost may bring on despair and hopelessness. And their loneliness experiences. If they experience loneliness, this loneliness experience theirs, if and when they cease to fascinate others, are a real torture. Everything in them is bolstered by external authority. They need authority to bolster their assurance. Their philosophy is built on expediency. Their reactions are eclectic, not original. And they try to enhance their shattered personality by leaning on others. When these others thrust them off, there is nothing left for them but despair and defeat. But it's a bitter defeat. They resemble the old wife of an Oriental potentate who gave everything she had, beauty, devotion, love to her master, and who discarded her for the sake of a younger girl. If you'll take the Bible, I always like to quote the Bible. What did the concubines mean to Ahasuerus? After he married Esther. Because this person is a shifting personality, and a shifting personality is the loneliest being on earth. And a shifting personality cannot be a good Jew. Not a good man, and certainly not a good Jew. It's out completely. We rabbis, let me say this as a confession, I mean, we rabbis are very bad in this regard. We try to be everything under the sun, but not ourselves. You try to be all that else, promoters, even social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, play the role of scholars, of publicists, of journalists, of authors. It's very nice. But in the first line, we must be ourselves, be a rabbi. We have no confidence in ourselves. We lack our self-experience as a rabbi. And that's why, I mean, the rabbinic profession, and it fails, not because the people are not sincere, no. Not the rabbis fail, not because they're insincere. I know many rabbis are very sincere, and very devoted, and have a sense of commitment. Simply, they are not rabbis because they are not themselves. They are trying to imitate someone, to find grace with society, to get approval of society. And one is effed out for approval, for applause, cannot be a rabbi. He can be an artist, perhaps, on the stage, a movie actor, but not a rabbi. This is the main trouble with American rabbinates. When I speak of American rabbinates, I mean all shades included. The Orthodox rabbinate, conservative, reform rabbinate. We are everything under the sun but ourselves. This is reflected in our language, this is reflected in our sermons, this is reflected in our articles, this is reflected in our approach to life. We do many jobs and badly. Because we cannot say attend to the many needs of the person. If there is social need, there is a social worker. If there is mental distress, there is a psychiatrist. The rabbi has to deal with one aspect of the personality, and this aspect is completely misunderstood by the rabbi for a certain reason, because he's not himself. And this example, of course, applies to other professions. Well, I cannot talk about other professions. But the rabbinic profession is certainly is affected by it. On the other hand, gentlemen, there are persons who, despite their commitment to the outside world, many a time bordering on the sacrificial, I want to know. To be oneself does not mean to work, does not mean the egotism. Under the circumstances, many persons, despite their commitment to the outside world, many a time bordering on the sacrificial, never forget their own private world. What I call it the charisma, the specific endowment of uniqueness and solitude, the numinous, the mysterious, that can never be thrust outside of the eye. Their charisma, their message, is fashioned not after the demands of society, but after an inner urge flowing from the mysterious and unknowable source. The story they tell, although somehow objectified and universalized through the medium of the abstract language of the logos, has not rid itself of the paradoxical and singular. On the contrary, their message is strange. There is originality. You find people, when they say a sentence, one single sentence, there is nothing exciting about the sentence, but the syntax of the sentence reflects originality. And you have people who have a beautiful vocabulary, almost unlimited, and they use the most beautiful word, but you'll take a look at the structure of the sentence, of one sentence, you'll find just comment and reflection copy, and what I call it, mental plagiarism. Thank you. On the contrary, we find people, on the contrary, their message is strange, peculiar. Even the lingual symbols used by them in their dialogues and monologues are different from the vernacular. They betray original creative power. There are no cliches in the language. No phrases, no flowers, I mean, it is simple, straight, but there is some, you'll find between the lines, the fingerprints of a unique personality. The charisma is not syncretic, nor eclectic, not just collected. See, I have the impression when I read sometimes the sermon of a rabbi, that he collected just sentences from many books. That's my impression. I don't know whether I'm wrong or right, but this is my impression. Apparently his mind is eclectic. Is it just a storehouse, I mean? Where he opens probably one compartment and finds phrases. The phrases don't have to represent thought. The phrase is the purpose for itself. Because the man who has, so to say, who does not experience himself, his uniqueness, his numinous character, of course, basically operates with phrases, not with ideas. They, on the contrary, the numinous person, does not plagiarize nor copy popular slogans, nor does it attempt to serve the existent and the accepted. The numinous I, with all its vigor and strangeness, although remote and uncommunicative, inspires indirectly whatever the numinous I in them inspires, whatever they do, their sermon, their speech, their writings, their activities. The charismatic Adam betrays to some extent the secret of the numinous solitary Adam. Always dark, always for themselves, even when they preach at market squares and at the corner of busy streets, the numinous eye remains for himself. These people know, of course, of loneliness when their message is scoffed and disdainfully condemned, yet their loneliness is caused not by a capricious crowd, which the individual tried to please at the highest cost of losing his own self. But their message is scoffed when it is scoffed at, but by, because their message is too unique, very independent. Charts, it's all, I mean, it's, It is scoffed at because the one who delivers the message lives for himself even when he attempts to establish communication with others. At the root of this feeling lies the great experience of aloneness. If I should try to coin a name for this feeling of aloneness, I would call it the prophetic loneliness. It would be an equation between prophetic loneliness and aloneness. Prophetic loneliness is not the loneliness of the person, as I said, of the concubine who was, I mean, thrown away by the Oriental tyrant of potentate, by Ahasuerus. It's prophetic loneliness. The isolation of Abraham carrying the message of the unknowable, invisible God. The isolation, the aloneness of Abraham, not condoning social evil and demanding the eradication of entrenched wrong. The solitude of Moses, following the episode with the golden calf, when he took his tent and pitched it without the camp, afar off from the camp. You have a Bible? This is not the ordinary feeling of loneliness. If you open just the Bible, it is Exodus 33. I mentioned it. Will Exodus 33, verse 7. And took the tabernacle and pitched it without the camp, afar off from the camp, and called it the tabernacle of the congregation. And it came to pass that everyone which sought the Lord went out unto the tabernacle of the congregation which was without the camp. It's aloneness, not loneliness. Not the crowd rejected Moses. Moses retreats from time to time from the crowd. It's a big difference. And it's interesting. And it came to pass when Moses went out unto the tabernacle that all the people rose up. He was respected by the crowd, admired by the crowd, although misunderstood by the crowd. And stood every man at his tent door and looked after Moses until he was gone into the tabernacle. And it came to pass, as Moses entered into the tabernacle, the cloudy pillar descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle in its complete isolation, complete aloneness. The cloud separated between him and the people. And the Lord talked with Moses, of course. If one is alone, the Lord talks with him. If he is lonely, the Satan ridicules him. Now the Lord talks with him. This is the difference. Or, for instance, the aloneness of an Elijah who fled to the Horeb Mount, who when summoned by God to come outside the cave and answer a few questions. If you'll just be so kind and you'll take Kings 1. Imagine it. Kings 1. Oh, Kings 2. Kings 1. Yes, Kings 1. Just a minute. Okay. Yes. Kings 1. Kings 1, chapter 19. And verse 9. Kings 1, chapter 19, verse 9. And he came thither unto a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said unto him, what dost thou hear, Elijah? It means, why did you retreat in a cave? Why don't you mingle with the crowd? You are a prophet. And he said, and Elijah answered, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of the hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I only am left, levadi, alone, and they seek my life to take it away. Again, expression of loneliness. The prophet Moses, the aloneness was due to the fact there was no liaison between Moses and the people. Moses was disappointed. Moses towered above the people. The people couldn't understand him. Moses felt that from time to time he should retreat from the camp into himself. And the pillar of the cloud separated him from the people. In Elijah, the story is a little different. He was persecuted because he was the champion of truth, the champion of the God of Israel, the champion of justice. He fought against all these heathen corruption, pagan habits, and idolatrous cults. He was persecuted. He fled. Moses didn't flee. Elijah fled. But not the lonely person who is in despair, but the person who is alone, he is proud of his aloneness. The prophet is not lonely, he is rather alone. To be alone, as I have stressed before, is identical with being the only one. The Greek monos, the Latin salus, the Hebrew yachid, would convey the aloneness experience. Elijah said that he was a lonely prophet, but that was not, he did not say that he was a lonely prophet, but that he was the only prophet, levadi, the short and the levadi. Prophetic, if you ask me, and all prophets were lonely, I would say in a sense lonely. Why? You'll find the description of Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezra, all of them. There is a certain air of loneliness, a certain sense of loneliness hovering in the air. Why were they lonely? In the sense, rather alone. Why? Because prophetic loneliness or aloneness is a result of kerygmatic incongruity, of prophetic strangeness, of an existence which is desecrated to something. The existence of the crowd is a non-desecrated existence, basically. It was true in olden times. It is still true today. The crowd is not desecrated. It is an existence with commitments to a singular goal. It's a result of an ideal which is unique and a result of an outlook which is strange. The human being is alone when he cannot exercise his powers. To engage in conversation, to impart his aspirations, longings, and visions to the crowd, because the receptive capacity is either limited or the crowd does not understand him. He tries to give of himself, to teach, to exhort, to guide. He wants to share his existential experience with others, to join up with his fellow man, but all his efforts are rejected since he is misunderstood. While at the first level of loneliness about mother man, the individual becomes useless to the crowd because his creativity and ingenuity have dried up, have run dry. At the prophetic plane, the aloneness is not the result of, so to say, of sterility. On the contrary, the giver abounds in all these talents. There is no recipient. The recipient is absent. Either he is incapable of or unwilling to grasp the prophetic message which refutes traditions, invalidates accepted standards, and revolutionizes, truisms and commonplaces and philosophical outlooks, thinking and action. God is alone, but he is not lonely. The prophet is alone, but he is not miserably lonely. And let there be no mistake, prophetic solitude is a very painful and tormenting experience. Yet, it is frequently a stimulating experience as well, and which drives men to creativity, to carry on, while loneliness in the general sense paralyzes or immobilizes all capabilities, all talents, or attitudes in man. And I want you to understand, when I speak about a prophet, I must say the prophet may be a very useful man. Doesn't mean a man who doesn't participate in society. He may be involved in the cooperative effort of society. He may participate in the reciprocal arrangements which are responsible for the flow of goods and exchange of services within a respective community. He's not a hermit. I'm not speaking about a hermitage. Yet this fervent activity in the realm of the utilitarian order of things does not dispel the tragic being alone experience. He belongs to society, at the same time finds himself at an endless distance away from it, alien and strange, to his friends and acquaintances. He belongs, cooperates, meets them every day. He's a very productive person. He's not a schlemiel. He's not a misfit in the society. He's not crazy. It's not madness on the part. He is active in society. He can contribute the most, greatly to our the general welfare. But still, he doesn't submerge in society. He has a world for himself. The like story of Abraham or the other patriarch or even Moses or Elijah picture this paradoxical ambivalence. Abraham negotiates with the Hittites, purchases land from them, concludes treaties with kings and princes. His mannerism does not differ from theirs. His routine is the same. And yet, reading the story of Abraham, he's the same person, the same Hittite, the same Jew, the same member of the Canaanite society. Yes. His speech, his dress, his manners, his habits of eating, He also observes the etiquette, the general rules of etiquette, of courtesy and politeness, and talks like one of them. And still, between the lines, you feel Abraham is different. He's unique. He's not like Ephron the Hittite, or Avimelech, the king of the Philistines, or like Pharaoh, the king of the Egyptians. He's different. It's hard sometimes to define in what respect is different. What is exactly this mark of distinction? He's a figure who towers above them, but not so much above them as a figure who is both at the same time. He is within society and at an endless distance from society. This is Abraham, and this is also Moses, and this is also Elijah. You see, our picture of the prophet is not commensurate with the picture of the saint in the gospel. It's not the father of the desert. The fathers of the desert simply condemned society. Because society stands for a sinful order of things. They condemned, they simply said goodbye and retreated into the cave. Into the caves or into the desert. They were, as far as the fathers of the desert are concerned, and they are the fathers of the church, of the Christian church, we may say they simply cultivated either odium sepuli, hatred of the interim period, because to Christianity, history is just an interim period between two arrivals of Christ. The historical arrival which took place 1900 and so many years ago, and the second arrival of Christ, when he'll sit in judgment over the world. What happens between is nothing but a between, just an interim period. So it means this means seculum, and that's where you say secular. When we use the word secular, it doesn't mean mundane. It means more interim. But it is interim. It means it is like we call twilight, the Hebrew word binash mashot, twilight. It's neither day nor night. So you have to live, of course, in the interim. And many generations kept on living, dying in the interim, and Christ hasn't come yet. But it is odium sepuli means I hate it, because it's no existence. Existence is corrupt, sordid, has no meaning, meaningless, insensate, paradoxical. Odium. It's simple, yes. Odium sepuli. At best you can say they didn't cultivate odium sepuli, at least contemptus sepuli. They had contempt for it. I wouldn't say they hated it, they had contempt for it. Nothing of that sort can you find among the Jewish prophets. Neither odium sepuli nor contemptus sepuli. There was neither hate nor contempt for this world, because the prophets fought for this world. They fought for this world, for this social order. They wanted to change it, they wanted to reform it, they wanted to rehabilitate men, they wanted to raise men to a higher level. But man is good, basically. At least he has potentialities, great potentialities, at least. So it's not the aloneness of the fathers of the desert, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. It is the aloneness of a father who does not find contact with his son. Many times, father don't find contact with their sons. They can't communicate their ideas to their sons. It's not a curse of, an old curse, but it's very modern. Sometimes we feel there is a gap between ourselves and our sons and our daughters. Would you say there is odium or contemptus? No. Our love for them is not affected, but still we are at a certain distance from them. It's exactly the relationship of the prophet to the world, to society. He loves society. He sacrifices himself for society. He gives everything he has to society. Everything he has. And the preachers, the preachers' ideals for society, for this interim society, for the secular, not for world to come, for this interim period. But on the other hand, he finds himself at a distance. And is one of them and nevertheless a mysterious and unknown figure. Perhaps I would say the two introductory words that were uttered by Abraham in his speech, in his addressing himself to the Hittites, reflect this dichotomy. If you'll take the Genesis, just a moment, I'll tell you where it is. It's interesting. Genesis, Chayesoro, yes. Chayesoro, Genesis, it is 23, verse 3. Verses 3 and 4, very interesting. And Abraham 19, Genesis 23, excuse me, comma 3, 4. And Abraham stood up from before his dead, when Sarah died, and spake unto the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger, interesting, and a sojourner with you. And the translation is not correct. It's, I am a stranger and an old resident. In your land, both. A stranger and an old resident. Sojourner is little, has again this, I would say, the meaning of it semantically means more temporary, or temporary state. But Peshav means an old-timer. I am a stranger and an old-timer with you. It's a funny introduction. He's either a stranger, an immigrant, a newcomer, or he's an old-timer, a citizen. How can one hold both, the status of a citizen, and also at the same time the status of a stranger, of an alien? But Abram told the Hittites, I am both. I am alien, and also to you, and also a friend of yours, an acquaintance of yours. Very strange. This is exactly what he said, reflected history. Charismatic man in society, he was a member of their society for. A numinous man, he was for himself. In particular, was a prophet, his inner world was so apart from their world that he was a stranger. On the contrary, the way he expressed himself, he acted, his mannerism, his speech, his dress, his knowledge, his background, they were identical. Is the externals which were cultivated by the Hittites. Now let me see, it's very important for our problem, for our Jewish problem. And I'll tell you, I'm trying, as I told you, I'm not preaching here, but I'm beginning to tread on dangerous ground, you see. Up to here, you see, I've explored areas in which there is no disagreement. As far as Jewish social ethic is concerned, we are all unanimous. Not even the non-Jews are. There is unanimity even among Jews and the better non-Jews, the real scholars. What Jewish social ethic means and the great contribution it made toward the understanding of man and his death. But here I'm venturing a little bit in the parochial realm. So, I'm not preaching. I told you before, I'm sharing my own experience with you. It was both a personal experience to me as a person, as an individual, and also as a Jew. But my life story is one of the wandering Jew. I've been in so many lands, and I had to establish contact with so many cultures and languages that simply I had to come to grips, with this problem of loneliness and aloneness, and I had to solve it. Otherwise, I thought, many times that I was ready to commit suicide, I told you last time. So all I say is I'm sharing my experience, as I understand, myself as a Jew and as a man. I want to say something else. Loneliness and aloneness represent or symbolize two aspects in man. Fate manifests itself in loneliness. Destiny in aloneness. What's the difference between fate and destiny? What's the difference between fate and destiny, ladies and gentlemen? If there is no difference, of course we use it. I mean, in our colloquial, we substitute fate for destiny and destiny for fate, I mean. But I don't believe that they are both equivalent at the level of semantics. If you analyze the words properly, in Hebrew, the words are more beautiful. Fate is goral, it's in Yiddish too, gerol, goral. It's like throwing lots, you see, goral. And I draw lots out of a basket. And destiny, there is a modern word for it, a beautiful word, yeut. Yeut, something prepared, yeut. Yud ayin vav dalet. Yeut. Yud ayin vav dalet. It means, yoed means to prepare, to commit, to obligate, to accept, or to designate. Fate, gerol, denotes, if you'll ask me what I understand by fate, and what a Jew should understand by fate, denotes what the famous German existentialist, I mean, before the Second World War, who later turned a Nazi, famous Martin Heidegger, was a monk. I studied under him. He was a monk. And calls the state of being thrust in. A man is always in a state of being, he called it in German, hineingeworfen, being thrust in, or cast in, or thrown in. Where? Where is man cast in? Where? In an order which is neither sympathetic, nor even too, nor even tolerant of one's questing for meaningfulness and greatness. Man somehow is taken by his lapel and thrown into a world which he did not choose, certainly not, he was not consulted before he was born, and into an order of things and events, mechanical order of things and events, which has neither sympathy nor understanding for man and his needs. Fate denotes the tragic conflict between two orders, the meaningful and the nonsense. Because nature around ourselves is nonsensical, simply nonsensical. There is no purpose, there is nothing. It's a mechanical occurrence, nothing else. Guided by the laws of physics, mathematical formulas, which don't make any sense, basically. Yeah. Law of gravitation, does gravitation make sense? Doesn't make any sense. There is no purpose to it, there is no telos to it, there is nothing. It's a law, it's a mathematical law. Yes. There are no values in this order, no values. And man cannot live without values, without ideals. And there's always a clash between the insensate or absurd order, mechanical order, and the axiological, I mean, values, axiological order, which man pursues, and which man wants to attain. It is the conflict between the teleological order set by a free creative personality and a mechanical order of the cosmic appearance. This is fate. What is destiny? What is destiny? Of course, destiny denotes also the state of being cast in. Because you cannot speak of human destiny unless you say that destiny represents also this tragic, so to say, experience, a man feeling that he didn't choose the life, I mean, he's living, but it was foisted upon him, imposed upon him, and he was thrown into a certain environment, and the environment determined everything he is and everything he stands for. I mean, as to the first, so to say, as the point of departure, fate and destiny are identical. Also, destiny also denotes the state of being cast in into an unfriendly world, the clash between spirit and matter, between man and nature, between machine and telos, between fullness, meaningfulness, and emptiness, between a blooming garden and a desert. Also. But the point of departure is the same. However, fate and destiny differ not as to the point of departure, but as to the problem, what should men do with it? This is exactly the existentialist problem. They don't give an answer properly. What should men do with it? True, he was thrown in. He was cast into an unfriendly world. There isn't much. To speak of freedom of will is a very precarious job. So shall I give up or shall I carry on? Shall men become, as theologians say, and they say it beautifully, shall human existence become a factum, a fact only? Or it should become an actus, an act, a creative act. This is here the problem. While fate, they give fate and destiny, give two solutions to this problem. While fate denotes the tragic sequel to that epic struggle, the defeat of men by absurdity and nonsense, destiny closes the chapter with a great finale, with men's not complete victory. As I said before, there is no complete victory, at least partial victory. Fate is reflected, you'll ask me, for two metaphors in the Bible, where one event reflected fate, hopelessness of man, complete defeat, crushing defeat, and another event which reflected man's destiny,
man's ability to tower above circumstances, above this mechanical crazy order of things and ends. Polyscientific order, polytheory, anything you want. Doesn't matter. I would quote two episodes. Fate is reflected in Moses' defeat on the threshold of the promised land. He wanted to go into it. He was standing on Mount Nebo, glancing the land. Simply craving, yearned to cross this narrow Jordan River and put his foot on the soil of the Holy Land. That's all that he wanted.
And the angel of death ridiculed his dream, his great vision, and blocked the way. This is fate. Moses somehow couldn't triumph over the angel of death. This is fate. Then Moses' life, the last minute, Moses' life was not a free creative act. It was a factum. He accepted, bowed his head before this unalterable fate, and died a lonely person. You'll ask me, where is destiny? Destiny is reflected in Moses' victory over the rock. When Moses took his cane and hit with the cane over the rock, and the rock yielded water, this symbolizes the great triumph of the spirit over matter, of men over insensateness, nonsense, and absurdity in nature, of men infusing some logic in his environment, or some semblance of coherence and orderliness in a crazy, friendly, unfriendly environment. Moses dying on the Mount Nebo, glancing at the shores of that land of Canaan, not being able to cross the Jordan River, is the manifestation of fate. Jacob struggling, again, another land, Jacob struggling with the divine antagonist. Martin Buber said that this chapter dealing with the struggle is perhaps the highlight of the Jewish experience. I'm inclined to agree with him in some respect. If you'll just open the Bible, and you'll take, just a moment, yes, the Bible, and you'll just take 33, verse 25, Genesis 33, verse 25. Here is dramatized the struggle between men and fate, and triumph of men of hate. Vayivoser Yaakov levado, and Jacob was left alone. But that not a lonely person. The lonely person is defeated. The person who is alone sometimes is triumphant. And there wrestled a man with him, very mysterious man, until the breaking of the day. And when he saw, it means the man saw, that he prevailed not, he cannot prevail over Jacob, against him, cannot prevail not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. And then 27, and he said, the man said, let me go. Jacob was so triumphant that he simply kept the man, held the man in his grip. And the man not only didn't defeat Jacob, but couldn't free himself. But when dawn, and the day, when this daybreak, he wanted to leave, I mean, this, so to say, Jacob, he couldn't free himself. Let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, Jacob said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. You must concede defeat. And he said unto him, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with man, and hast prevailed. This is exactly men wrestling with destiny. And somehow emerging from this struggle, triumphant, of course, not in terms of absolute victory. Jacob also then had his defeat with Joseph. But he is triumphant sometimes. Jacob bowing, and you want to ask me again, where did Jacob reflect an event? Reflect again fate in Jacob's life? Because Judaism does not consider that a human being can completely convert his fate into destiny. Of course, at certain moments he rises to great heights and he forges his own destiny. At certain moments he's so helpless and weak that he just bows to fate. Jacob himself, who struggled with the antagonist, it was a divine antagonist, somehow mysterious antagonist, and displayed so much heroism, so much fortitude and courage. Jacob himself, in the same chapter 33, verse 3, and he passed over before them when he met his brother Esau and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Where's the courage in Jacob? Why did he bow to Esau? Why didn't he engage Esau in a struggle and defeat Esau as he defeated the divine antagonist? This is the tragedy of man. Man fluctuates between fate and death. But of course, I mean, at certain moments, even the greatest among us bows to fate, has no courage, simply to forge his own destiny and to become the master over his environment. Yes, sir. I mean, there's Dr. Eisenberg asked me before. You wanted to ask me something.
I wanted to ask you whether, in the light of what you said before, Judaism rejected Essenism as a way of life.
I'll tell you. As a matter of fact, it's hard to say. We know so little about the Essenes that it's hard to judge them. I don't believe that the Essenes were cultivating what do you call odium mundi, hatred of the world. It's more was in the sense of an order, of course. They developed practices I wouldn't say self-torture, but at least of self-discipline. But to say that the Essenes are like the fathers of the desert or the medieval monks would be unjust to them. As to our attitude, the Talmud does not mention them, you know, very well. Uh-huh. And the fact the Talmud ignore them means there isn't complete approval of their practices. Yes. This was one of the...
How about Trappistic monasticism?
I beg your pardon?
The monasticism of the Trappists.
Of course, I mean, we reject all kinds of monasticism, because monasticism means complete disengagement. It's all a question of degrees, but of course, I mean, monasticism it preaches disengagement from society. Prophetic solitude never preached disengagement from society, complete engagement in social activities, giving of oneself as much as possible, but from time to time, retreat on the part of the individual into himself. Monasticism means complete retreat. I mean, there isn't the dialectical movement. I always speak of dialectical movement like a pendulum, which swings back and forth. This should be actually, this is the philosophy of Judaism with regard to man. Monasticism is not a pendulum swinging back and forth. I mean, all forms of monasticism, the milder forms and the more extreme forms, please just movement in one direction, away from. Judaism says away from and back to.
Celibate?
It's hard to see. It looks like that. It's hard to say. We know that it'll perhaps these documents which we have discovered lately, the scrolls, perhaps will shed more light upon these things. Yes, sir. What did you want to ask, Mr. Zekerman?
Faith and destiny. It's one a question of defeat and the other one a question of victory at all times.
I've meant trying. No. I said not. One is defeat, complete defeat, and one is victory whenever possible.
But
there's no promise of victory, I want to say. There's no
victory
promise.
Victory always connected with the supernatural?
No. Did I mention it?
Well, you didn't say it that way.
No, so why should you suspect me of...
Well, I have a right to imply
something. Okay, no, I'm just there, sir. All I said, of course, if you call the help of God supernatural, sir. But God can intervene, you see, in a very natural way, through the cosmos.
But is it possible for man to determine his own destiny or to help himself?
To a some extent.
Without the aid of God?
No, I wouldn't say that. I'll come as far... I know your point. I'll come later to your point. The question of the secular Jew. For the time being, I speak of a Jew. He's a Jew not for himself, but before his creator. This is... This gentleman asked.
Ray, when you first started to speak, you talked about that man is bound to be defeated in life.
Finally. In death. In death, man, when he dies, is not a man of destiny, but a man of fate. Every man. Moses, Jacob, Abraham, there is no man on his deathbed who forges his destiny, but man who succumbs to fate. To cruel, insensate, crazy, simply fate. All right, yes, sir.
I'm trying to translate this psychologically in terms of what it does to any man.
You mean in practical terms? As to consequences, in my opinion, yes, please.
Well, and also whether or not there is sufficient difference between the Jewish as against the Christian attitude, where man is doomed almost from the beginning.
Yes, there is only one difference.
This is fundamental.
I understand very well. In Christianity, men cannot act. All men can do is wait for God to intervene and receive his grace. Nothing else. Men cannot change himself. Men cannot triumph over circumstances. It's only the grace of God. I'll come to it later. Judaism is a system of freedom of will. Whether scientists of today agree with that or not, it's a basic tenet of Judaism. Freedom. Man is free to act. God may be helpful, but God never takes the initiative. Man has to take the initiative. God perhaps clinches, completes the job, consummates his endeavor. But initiative must be taken by man. Christianity, on the contrary, the initiative is God's. Perhaps man can participate later, but the beginning belongs to God. This is the basic difference. That's why Christianity, Judaism, preached activism. For instance, the question of disease. Christianity couldn't cope with disease. Christian science, until now, cannot understand the problem of healing a person who is inflicted by a disease. Yes, if God inflicted evil, some man should suffer. That Catholics have hospitals now, trained doctors, is just a concession to the so-called seculum, to the interim period. Nothing else. A concession, nothing else. Judaism and the Bible, thousands of years ago, there are still people who thought of sickness in terms of spirits and ghosts. The Bible said, therapy, and the doctor should heal. The physician should heal. Activism. Active combat of evil. I'll come yet to the problem of evil. I mean, it does not interfere with Jewish activism. But there is only one thing. Activism does not imply an assurance, ipso facto, an assurance of success. And that's exactly what I think is wrong with modern man. He won when he is active, when he gives, when he is his best, so to say, to a project, to an ideal, he wants to be assured of success. And if success, I mean, does not come his way, and many times it happens so, in our individual lives, in our national, with regard to our national problems, so man is completely shattered. Let's continue for a while. Yes, sir.
We talk about this world not being the world of interim. What about the discussion in the Talmud about whether it is better that man be created or not be created?
Just a different problem. I'll tell you frankly. I'm still in doubt about it. This problem has not been resolved for me yet, whether man should have been created or not. What does the Talmud say?
But now that he's created...
It would have been better if man hadn't been created at all. But since he is created, he was created, let him act. That's what Talmud says. He fashed with my mouth, so let him act. Metaphysically, perhaps the best solution, the best exit, I mean, of all our paradoxical situations would be nihility. Of course, complete non-existence of man. But since man exists, the Talmud said, yifash pesh b'masav, let him act. Let him understand himself and act. Let me continue. Each one, gentlemen, can convert fate into destiny if he infuses into a seemingly stupid situation some sense and purposefulness. When directedness is added to fate, fate is not directed, does not aim at anything. When directedness and purposiveness is added to fate, destiny is born. And loneliness turns into aloneness, or prophetic solitude. Then the frustrating element is eliminated, anxiety can be conquered, and the disjunctive emotion of worthlessness may be converted into an elevating feeling. What is needed is the courageous act of recentering the personality and shifting emphasis from the without to the within. At the first stage of loneliness, anxiety, at the first stage of loneliness, anxiety, the afflicted person goes out of himself into the surrounding world. His self-appraisal revolves not around the unique inner self, the unfathomable individuality in all its charismatic singularity, but about the pale reflection against the backdrop of externalization. His self-esteem is measured by conventional outside standards of accomplishment and conquest. Majesty is the keynote of self-evaluation for modern men. Don't stop being majestic. Majestic usually is equated with power. Powerful. Powerful doesn't mean only political power in the sense of Hitler or Stalin or Khrushchev. What I mean more, it should make an imprint upon society. His footsteps should not be lost, completely erased when he disappears from the stage. To have a hold of a society, somehow. This is majesty. It's a very worthy objective. Yes, majesty is the keynote of self-valuation. And majesty is measured by success. And success is the determining factor. And in the second phase, when man is within himself, for himself, when it's not fate anymore, he's not fate, he doesn't represent fate but destiny, majesty takes a secondary place to a much higher objective, dignity. There's a difference. Dignity, not majesty. Before you become majestic, you should be a dignified being. And dignity cannot be realized if man looks into a mirror constantly and wants to see his reflection. And of course, the mirror is the Tao. He's not a dignified person. On the contrary, he lacks dignity. He's copying, he's plagiarizing, he's imitating, dignity goes hand in hand with originality, creativity, being himself, being what he is, not what others think of him. I'll still come back when I'll speak about the Jewish observance, about the problem of dignity and majesty. It's a very important problem. Because David told man, v'kovod v'hador te'atreyu. It means you surround him with majesty and dignity. I'll show you what it is, where it is in the Psalms. I exactly don't remember the chapter, the number of the chapter, but it's somewhere in the beginning. No. It is Keresh Amecho Masez Besecho, Yeriach Vekhovim. Here I have it. I believe, just a moment. Yeah. It is Psalm 8. Yeah. Wait, Psalm. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, not the angels, than God, actually. And thou crownest him with glory and honor. It's a wrong interpretation, a translation. Kavod in Hebrew means majesty. Baruch Shom Shem Kvod Malchuse means his majesty. Kvod Malchuse, what means Kvod Malchuse? His royal majesty. Kavod means majesty, and Hador does not mean beauty, but dignity. So David actually has defined man as a being who can be both majestic and dignified. It's all a question of order, of priority. What comes first, majesty or dignity? Man can attain both, but it depends how he starts out on his way. What's the point of departure? The point of departure is not majesty, it's dignity. And dignity is not outside of man, but within him.
Appropriation is the act of destiny.
You mean natural procreation? Yeah. It's both. It is fate and destiny. A man can actually act as a father both according to the dictates of fate, and he can also, his fatherhood convert into an aspect of destiny. Both. Man procreation is animal. It's an animal function. On the other hand, fatherhood is a concept, which is closely knitted to his humanity. Of course, men can act as a father both at the level of faith and level of destiny. I'll come to it. Prophetic solitude, I want to say, is not the share of the few. It is not an esoteric endowment. It belongs to men in general, because his charismatic election manifests itself mainly in dignified appearance rather than in majestic triumphs or in majestic winning. Even the old, the sick, the crippled, the simpleton, the anonymous person, the lonely person may elevate himself from the awareness of loneliness to that of being alone. The abandoned, the deserted, the isolated person is lost. The inmate of an institution is lost, is a number. The prisoner in a cell is lost, is a number. For the outside world is nothing. There is no kerygma which he is able to pass on. There is no message which society, desires to hear or to accept. But if it's a question of no majesty to the prisoner, no majesty to the inmate of a home for old, for the old, there is no majesty to the sick person in a hospital for incurable diseases. But there can be dignity. Because dignity is within. All he has to do to withdraw, he has got to accept a little bit of defeat. Defeat by society. And withdraw from the craving for majestic living. From the outside, from his craving for outside recognition, and turning his glance toward a worthy, dignified existence. Now, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, let us speak about the Jew a while. For the Jew of today,
just a moment, yes.
And basically, it means when I speak about dignity, man should exile himself for a while. I mean, mentally, inwardly, from society, in its standards. But this exile results later in return, basically. If man is proud of himself, and he can exile himself from society, it results later in return. You know, in the Bible, always there is no exile without return, exile. Politically, always exile, return. Man himself can go through this experience of exiling himself. I lost the society. You know, you reach, as a rabbi, you know, I deliver a speech. The speech is not accepted by the crowd. I am in despair. I'm old, so I don't care too much about it. But a young rabbi, I can, when I meet one of my students, So I mean, of course, I meet, usually I come into New York on Tuesday or Wednesday, and I see your speech was bad on Saturday morning. Right? You just need, all you have to do is take a look at his face. And then I read his speech. Sometimes the speech was bad. And then sometimes it was a wonderful speech, but the people there in the congregation were stupid. They couldn't understand. But the rabbi, it doesn't matter. He never asked himself a simple question. Did I fail because I didn't prepare a good speech? Then it means it's a lack of dignity. It was not creative. Actually, his dignity is affected. Or did I fail because the speech was stupid? It was a buff. Yes. Then it's not my fault. There's no majesty, of course, involved. Majesty means when the orator establishes contact with the crowd, with the audience, above. But dignity should not be affected. And as long as one's dignity is not affected, the personality can have a wholesome experience of self worth and self, so to say, self-centeredness. Now let us tackle this problem of the Jewish loneliness. In this transition from loneliness to prophetic solitude, to unique existence, may lie the answer to our perennial problem of our loneliness as Jews, as a community, and also as individuals. We experience it quite often. Which has not disappeared with the birth of the Jewish state. On the contrary, the loneliness of the Jew was emphasized with the emergence of the Jewish state, of the state of Israel, has become more pronounced and more frightening. This was one of the mistakes of Herzl and political Zionism. They thought, we are lonely because there are people in exile. But the moment we'll establish a state, we'll send delegates to the United Nations, to any international assembly, and we'll have our ambassadors, and we'll exchange diplomatic notes, so we'll be equals. This is the basic philosophy of Herzl in the Medina Tayyurim, in the state of the Jews. This is the basic philosophy. This is, so to say, the undertone, so to say, of Medina Tayyurim. Of course, I mean, I don't have to preach too much about it. Not only did the individual Jew not gain a normal status in society, but even the Medina Tayyurim as a state is the loneliest state on earth. The loneliest, I can tell you, of course, it was the representatives of the Jewish state, the United Nations, how they feel. So one of the leading representatives, I don't want to mention him, told me, people think that there is glory in it. How foolish they are. It is such an excruciating experience to be a representative of the Jewish state. I am the loneliest creature on earth in the United Nations. And I said, you know, when I felt lonely, when America, the American representative, and the British representative, and the French representatives, France is supposed to be a good friend of Israel, the French representative, I mean, support my viewpoint. And they speak, I mean, in favor of Israel. I feel how isolated I am. In the lobby, I feel that the representative of NASA
As friends, he's a part of society. I'm outside. I'm just quoting verbatim. I didn't experience it. He was quoting verbatim. It's a fact. One of the leading representatives. I don't want to mention them. What is it? I want to understand. It became, maybe time a neurosis with Jews. Absolutely. Many times, it assumes forms of a neurosis. The Jew is so afraid of being isolated that he visualizes, that he pictures ghosts himself. It is just a figment of his imagination. Yes. But somehow I would like to discuss this problem, to analyze it a bit deeper, not to just leave it, to say, to dismiss it, just with a movement of our hand and say, it doesn't exist. There is a problem, there's a problem, I know it and you know it, everybody knows it. I would say that a Jew is lonely because he's too much bent on majesty. He wants to be too majestic, too impressive. If the Jew would cultivate dignity instead of majesty, many of his problems would be solved. Would be solved. We are too charismatic. It means we want to pass on a message. And we want society, general society, to appreciate our message. To praise us. To give at least lip service to us. Lip service, compliments. We are like a prima donna, who likes always to be in the limelight and always to hear the critics, I mean, praise our performances. We have a complex. We suffer from a prima donna complex, a nervous, capricious prima donna in many times. And of course, a nervous, capricious prima donna, what's the name of the one whose contract has been canceled by so many opera companies? Is, I would say, does not display a sense of dignity, I mean. Perhaps majesty, I don't know. Dignity, certainly not. We are like a prima donna. I believe when the Jew would recenter himself, recenter his personality as an individual and as a community, around, not around the aspect of dignity, many of his problems, I wouldn't say all his problems, but many, would be solved. Then the whole community will be called upon to experience, of course, also a crisis, but not a disjunctive, so to say, in a disjunctive manner, but something which is creative. For the Jew of today, the problem can be formulated as follows. And I'll be very, so to say, very ruthless in formulating this problem. There's no use of hiding the problem. Shall Jewishness remain a fate? Or shall Jewishness become a destiny for the Jew? Very simple. In terms of our previous definition of fate and destiny, shall the Jew act like Moses on the Mount of Nebo, feeling weak and helpless, not being able to triumph over the angel of death, who tried to frustrate his highest ambition? Or shall the Jew be like Moses, hitting the rock with his cane, and make the rock yield water? Shall the Jew bow before fate as Jacob bowed before Esau 7 times? Or shall the Jew struggle with fate and forge his own destiny the way the same Jacob struggled to be the divine antagonist through the night and emerge victorious? This is the problem. Shall Jewishness be a factor to be accepted? Or shall Jewishness be a free actus, an act on the part of man? Shall Jewishness be considered, as Heidegger says, the state of being thrown in, of being an eingeworfen, as Heidegger says? I was thrown in into the Jewish fold without the Creator consulting me before birth. I was thrown in into minority community, insecure and self-conscious, haunted by fears and uncertain presentiments. Shall we reconcile with this state of affairs? Then Jewishness becomes a nightmare. Let's not fool ourselves. A nightmare, a curse, a monstrosity. The Jew is tossed then, the Jew is tossed by the Satan, nowhere, along empty and dark spaces into tohu wabohu. Like the autumn wind drives the withered leaf along uncharted roots into the haze of nothingness. Jewishness as a fate, then the Jewish God, you know what his name is? It's very interesting. If Jewishness is a fate, de facto Jews, Jewishness as a facticity is also a God, perhaps a destructive God. You know what his name is? I'll show you in the Bible. Will you be so kind and open the Bible, Exodus chapter 5. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. And afterward, Moses and Aaron, Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. Verse 1, 2, 3. And afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness. And Elokei Yisrael. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go. And they said, they repeated the request, but they did something very peculiar. They changed the name of the God. First they call him the Lord, Havayah, Jehovah, the God of Israel, the eternal, the everlasting one, the God of Israel. Then they said, Elokeinu Ivrim, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. What's the difference between Elokei Israel, the God of Israel, and the God of the Hebrews? You know what Hebrews means? Ivri means lonely. Averanor, why was Abraham called Ivri? Abraham the Hebrew, because he was from the other side of the river. He was from Mesopotamia. He came from Mesopotamia into Israel. He was always a stranger. So actually means a Jew, if the Jew accepts fate, then he accepts God. But it's a strange God. I wouldn't like to be in his company. This is the God of the Hebrews, Elokeinu Ivrim, the God of loneliness, the God of strangeness, the God of not belonging, or of belonging nowhere. This is the If the Jew views himself in terms of his acceptance into general society, in categories of the Tao, in the mirror, according in terms of his reflection, the mirror of the press, politics, and artificial appraisal, then he feels isolated, expelled, and abandoned. Such a state of mind leads to all kinds of mental anomalies, including self-hatred. You must hate God because God isolated you. He's the God of loneliness, of suffering and cruelty. And if one hates God, he must ipso facto hate himself. Of course, what I want to interject now is perhaps homiletical. I know Dr. Eisenberg is very particular about it, but still it fits beautifully into that. When I see modern Jew who does not try to forge his Jewish destiny, but accepts it. Not accepts it, it was foisted upon him by his parents. The parents didn't do it, I mean, voluntarily either. I mean, he was thrown in an anger often. And how he's tossed by the wind of circumstances, of accidents, by the wind of capricious fate, blind, cruel, capricious fate. And he tries to hide himself. I always remind myself of the story of Jonah the prophet. It's a strange prophet. When Jonah was fleeing God, the trouble is that the God of loneliness is hard to flee. he catches up with you. And the question, the Book of Jonah. The Book of Jonah, it is among the 12 books. Jonah chapter 1, and verse 5. But Jonah was gone down into the back of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep. Wanted to forget about the fact that he's traveling on a ship, and the people somehow are trying to examine his background. So the shipmaster came to him and said unto him, "What meanest thou, a sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God. If so be that God will think upon us, that we perish not." And then you'll take verse 8. And then they said unto him, "Tell us, we pray thee, for whose cause this evil is upon us. What is thine occupation? And whence comest thou? What is thy country? And of what people are thou?" Sometimes we are pressed by the shipmaster, whoever he is, to acknowledge something about ourselves. It's a very embarrassing question, I tell you. I lived in Germany, gentlemen, many, many years. I knew assimilated Jews of Germany very well. And this question used to come up time and again. Whence, what is thy occupation? Whence comest thou? Why should they ask the Jews? The Jews lived in Germany longer than the Germans themselves, perhaps. At least as long as a civilized community. In the 9th or 10th century, I mean, there were Jews in Germany, certainly. Even Charlemagne already had dealt with Jewish communities. Until the question came up, and what people are thou? When this question is asked, there is only one answer to be given. And this answer can be given only by the person who accepts Judaism not as a faith, but as a destiny. And this answer gave Jonah the prophet. And he said, he understood that it's impossible to escape from God. And he said unto them, "I am a Hebrew. I am a lonely person. And I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, which hath made the sea and the dry land." The moment he gave this answer, there was a change in his philosophy. Complete change in his philosophy. However, there is no need for it. There is no need for it.
However, Jewishness should be raised and can be raised by every Jew. From the plane of nonsensical facticity to that of an intelligent destiny.
When fate is filled with sense, and you just take and infuse a little sense into fate, and meaning, teleological motives, and directedness, then the Jew exchanges loneliness, I wouldn't say for companionship, but at least for aloneness, for prophetic solitude. And his God is already not a Lekeo-Ivrian, but Havaya Elekei Yisrael, the God of Israel. The everlasting one, the God of Israel, which denotes, what does Israel mean? And I told you, why was Jacob called Israel? When was he called Israel? When he triumphed over the antagonist. Israel means the triumphant personality. Man triumphs over circumstances and fate, which denotes the charismatic community of victory, of spiritual power, of triumph over men and divine antagonists. Genesis 33:28, I read it this. However, in order to perform this metamorphosis of fate into destiny, I would use the Greek expression, metabasis is aliogenos, it means a jump into a different class. I mean, it's not an easy jump. It's quite possible. A Jew must become aware of his inner worth. This is number one. As a Jew, not always a person. Just speaking of as inner worth. Of his numinous character. Of his uniqueness as individual. Of his singular position with regard to God and to man. in a manner reminiscent of the spiritual personality in general. He has got to discover his greatness within his own existential experience, within himself. When I say uniqueness of a Jew, well, I want you not to misunderstand me. I mean it in the same sense as which I employed with regard to Abraham. Abraham was a Hittite, externally. I mean it not in terms of the external appearance, under no circumstance. I don't mean it in terms of dress, speech, mannerism, education, and also political, economic, and social commitment. He should be committed, involved. This was a Jewish tradition, involved in every institution of learning, in every institution of charity, in every institution of endeavor, of collective endeavor. In the country in which we live, this was the tradition of Abraham, this was the tradition inherited from Moses. Moses was an Egyptian prince. We don't preach, perhaps there are some, I wouldn't say, there is a lunatic fringe within Orthodoxy. I mean, I'm not trying to hide the fact which preaches separation, complete withdrawal, even external withdrawal. I am very far from this philosophy. For a simple reason, I mean, I don't have to go into detail, for a simple reason, you cannot practice it. I mean, it's the best reason. It's impossible. The Jew is integrated now in the general society, more or less. In spite of his feeling of loneliness and isolation, he is still integrated. You cannot change that, I mean. You cannot go back into ghetto. He's out. Any Orthodox movement which preaches return to the ghetto, he simply preaches suicide. National suicide. I don't mean that. I don't mean a ghetto. I've never meant it. Dress, speech, education, political, social, economic, even patriotic commitment. The Jew is a citizen of the country. With regard to all the things belonging into the sphere and activities of charismatic man, of men in society, who externalizes a part of himself, he makes a contribution to the general welfare, the Jew is equal to anybody else. The uniqueness of the Jew is related to the numinous aspect of him, to his inner world, in which he finds himself, strange and incomprehensible, to his questing for and addressing himself to God, to his emotional life, his depth personality, his yearnings and strivings, his love for others, his worldview, his private life, his sentimental relationships with his family, with his wife, with his children. There the Jew is unique and should discover in himself the experience of aloneness. It's a great experience, gentlemen. I'll show you later how it expresses itself. I'm speaking in vague terms now. Well, but probably the next lecture I'll take up this problem. Yes. If you will ask me how can I characterize Jewish uniqueness, I speak in Jewish uniqueness. You'll ask me, what is Jewish uniqueness? If you'll ask the Satmar Rebbe, he'll tell you what Jewish uniqueness is. Long kaftan, this and that, all right. I mean, the terms he'll use will not be vague or equivocal in any sense, but my terms will be equivocal, I guess.
But I don't want to employ this, so to say, dubious terms. I want to speak in very, spell out what my philosophy in unequivocal terms in categories. You'll ask me what is Jewish uniqueness. I won't be able to finish that, but I just want to start now.
How can Jewish uniqueness be expressed, gentlemen? Of course, I want you to say that more I'll have to speak as an Orthodox rabbi, not preaching my experience. Later, okay. You can take it, you can reject it. But it's a philosophy now, what I have. And I'm not speaking. Jewish uniqueness, in my opinion,
expresses itself in one thing. We are a unique community because we are a covenantal community. The word covenant, brit, in Hebrew, brit, covenant. Covenant is the basis of our historical experience. The covenant, our patriarch Abraham already concluded a covenant with God. And Genesis 15, verse 18, Genesis 15, verse 18 says, on the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given the land. Then, Genesis 17, comma 7, chapter 17, comma 7, and I, the Lord, said, and I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and between thy seed after thee, in the generations, for an everlasting covenant. What does covenant mean, of course? I just substituted one vicar for another vicar. What does covenant mean? I'll tell you what covenant means. Covenant, basically, and I have to introduce here an halakhic motif, but it means a contract. A contract. Nothing else but a contract. The interesting is, the famous philosopher or sociologist, actually, who created the discipline of sociology of religion, Max Weber, probably you heard of him, the German, he understood the concept. He wrote a book about the covenant concept. He understood it. He was a Gentile. He said, very well, covenant means a contract. And it is correct from a halakhic viewpoint. Covenant means a contract. Agreement. It's a contractual arrangement. Nothing metaphysical. A contractual arrangement. What? Of course, like any other contract. But any contract, what does any contract from a juridic viewpoint, what does it imply? What does a contract imply? If I sign a contract with you, of course, bilateral, not unilateral, commitment, of course. A contract implies commitment. Bilateral taking on of obligations.
This means a covenantal community. A community which is bound by certain commitments made at the dawn of its history and still binding upon generations to come. In a word, the Jewish people form a community of the committed. If you ask me, what are the Jewish people? A community, but not a free man completely, and I'm using not free in the sense, metaphysical sense, more in a derogatory sense, not a man, just are free to do anything they want, of people who are committed, not slaves, but people committed to something. We are a community of dedicated, of the dedicated ones, of the committed ones. A historical and metaphysical load has been placed upon our shoulders, and it's up to the Jew, it's up to him, either to consider this strange burden as something unwanted, and undesired, while trying to cast it off. And of course, if he tries to cast off like Jonah, he will not being able to cast off, to throw off this burden, Jewishness turns into a fate, into a curse. Or he can accept this commitment freely, the load freely accept, and dedicate himself to carry on and pass on. In this case, Jewishness becomes elevated to destiny. Yes. What did our commitment express itself, our historical commitment? I believe at two levels, and I believe basically I've accepted two obligations. About it, I'll speak next time.